Good evening, everyone. Good evening. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters. My name is Veronica Entwistle. And as you know, I like to bring you people that are making a difference, infusing change into our collective awareness at this time, this wonderful, turbulent, changeable time of history. And Lynn McTaggart has been a researcher around the world, making a huge impact with the field, then the intention experiment. And now I'm really excited to talk with Lynn and talk with you also about the bond and how, I don't know, Lynn, welcome to the show. I want to ask you something right away. Welcome to the show from jolly old England.
Thank you.
Your work is really exciting for me to dig into, for example, the bond. My first question to you is, do you think that we're just evolving enough to become aware of this unity, this oneness that we have, the depth under atoms and molecules and quarks and itsy bitsy bits of reality?
Are we evolving enough to be aware of it? I think that we're starting to become aware of it, and I think certain people are becoming aware of it. I think we have a ways to go. But I do think we have a sense that something is really shifting and changing. We tend to have a negative sense about it. You know, we really feel something is ending. So many of us look at all the crises that are besetting us in modern times, you know, whether it's ecological crises or economic crises and all the other kinds of crises. And we hear all the pundits saying things like, you know, scary things like it's the end of capitalism as we know it, or it's the end of oil, or it's the end of food, or even it's the end of the world. But I think what's happening now is we're being forced into a situation where what's ending is our really a false view of who we are. Mm-hmm. And I think this is good news, because in this ending is going to be really the path forward.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually that, you know, so many people have talked about 2012 with, of course, varying degrees of craziness, but one of the things I like is it's supposed to be the unfoldment. It's a time that represents an unfoldment of consciousness moving through our species. That's how I'm kind of interpreting it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
The way you're talking, I think it does require that. What you write about in The Bond is how that dog-eat-dog competitive drive, the Darwinian war amongst us all, has to change, doesn't it? And
absolutely.
Doesn't that...
Well, and it's against nature. And so it's, you know, it's dangerous for us because it's against nature. And we, you know, one thing that I was really interested in with this book was exploring, you know, were we made to be so competitive? Were we made to live like this? You know, was that what was supposed to happen? And if so, how come it's not working so well? And what I discovered in looking at the frontier science, you know, frontier physics, biology, psychology, anthropology, sociology, was that no, we were made to connect with each other. We were made to connect, not compete. When we unite, we survive and thrive. But when we compete, we lose. Hmm. So the answer is that that nature has designed us only in holism. And when we forget that, when we fight for ourselves and we live for ourselves, we lose.
Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm still curious about one thing. Do you think it's just about time that we wake up to this, or do you think we've just been blinded by our social constructs? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to wake up for this, or we won't survive. I think that nature is banging us over the head with it right now, you know. And I think we have to, and we're being forced to, which is a good thing, because anything that makes you wake up, whether it's positive or negative, is good. I think that certain people are evolving to that point anyway, mm-hmm. but I think probably had we not had these crises, we wouldn't be waking up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've defined ourselves in a certain way here in the West. You know, not every person in the world thinks like this. You know, lots of other cultures think very differently from we do. So I'm talking about we in the West. But we have defined ourselves like this. We, you know, many things write the story we live by, but science is one of the main authors of our lives, in a sense, in terms of writing and defining who we are and how we're supposed to live.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, we've defined ourselves as separate and competitive because of a couple of major forces in science and in industrial development. And because of that, we've created this world where we are, you know, we are, we believe that it's really essential for us to be in competition with each other, that competition creates excellence. And the problem is that that mindset is really causing us problems now. And so it's forcing us to review that thought. And when we do, we find, nature actually didn't design us in competition. Nature designed us to cooperate with each other. Nature designed human beings to share, care, and be fair. Mm-hmm. And when we do this, we thrive.
Well, in
when
the,
we don't, we don't.
In the field, you kind of proved that you talked about we're all one in the sense of sharing that energetic envelope, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in the intention experiment, I remember being fascinated by how many people together would share an intention which would have a huge impact on people. And now in this book, I'm fascinated by it's really interesting research you're doing, and I bet you get really excited sometimes.
But I do.
Just simply one of the examples I'm thinking of is in Japan, they don't really have the same heart problems as we do, and a lot of it is not about food or exercise. It's about connection, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Japanese have confounded epidemiologists because, you know, they have a very good diet, you know, a dairy-free and very healthy diet, but they also smoke like chimneys.
And they eat a lot of salt, don't they?
They smoke like chimneys, and they're supposed to have a lot of heart disease because of this. So epidemiologists looking at this were really puzzled, particularly when they looked at what happened when the Japanese migrate to places like America, and they found two things happened. When those Japanese that maintained a certain lifestyle came to America, they still had no heart disease. When they adopted the American go-ahead lifestyle, they began to have heart disease that mimicked that of the U.S. Now, they looked at this further, and they said, okay, this must be diet. But when they looked at the diet, it didn't matter whether the Japanese had Big Macs or ate tofu and sushi. If they had maintained close social ties with other people, particularly other Japanese, they were protected. If they didn't, and they became isolated like many Americans are now, many Western Americans, they found that their heart disease mimicked that of the rest of the country. So these epidemiologists were so fascinated by this, they went over to Japan to try to find the real key to, you know, the real X factor of impregnable health. And they went and talked to some of the Japanese and said, well, what is it? What do you guys do that's so different? And they said, oh, it's so obvious. You know, you Americans are so lonely. Anybody could see that. Anybody could see that. You know, you even walk down the street alone.
Mm.
And that was just amazing to them because it really indicated the problem, the nub of the problem. Loneliness.
Hmm. And I think that's true because I think a lot of us get up in the morning and wonder if we're going to be able to make it. There's kind of a drive, you know, about whether you can make it in this country, right?
Yeah, you know, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. You know, New York, New York.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the sense of, you know, the competitive, independent, individualist pioneer spirit of America. You know, get on here, get on for you and yours. You know, 1 in 39 people in America is a millionaire.
Hmm.
You know, so yeah, there is that mindset of me above all else, and you know, and that's really an inherent part of the American dream. But I'm necessarily criticizing individual innovation or
excellence
or drive. Mm-hmm. But what I am saying is really that something more fundamental is at stake here, and that is the human need to share, care, and be fair. The human need to belong is so great that people who kill themselves often suffer from what psychologists call excessive individuation. They're too individual.
Hmm.
They're too lone wolf. And that kind of person, the very person that we've considered the great American hero, is a perfect candidate for a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
John Wayne, Harrison Ford, Nicolas Cage, you know, Humphrey Bogart, Carrie Cooper, these guys who were, you know, always were the hero up against the establishment, the guy bucking the system, you know, the people who live themselves in their own creation, they're the people who are most likely going to die of a heart attack, according to statistics. The people who are lonely and not connected are people most likely to die of a heart attack, as well as many other diseases.
Well, what are some other countries and what their MO is, you know, besides Japan? Like, what about Canada, where they have medical coverage, or England, where they have medical coverage?
Well, the UK, I mean, here's the interesting thing about it. When you look at fairness and you look at caring, mm-hmm. it's really interesting to look at the statistics because, again, some epidemiologists looked at this. And they looked at what happens when countries are not fair and aren't caring. Mm-hmm. And they looked at all the Western countries, including the U.S. and the U.K. and Canada. And they found that the more the income disparity, big in income disparity, like in America where you've got half the world's billionaires, but you also have 39 million people below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
You've got those kind of huge disparity. What they found is that the more unfair a society, in the sense of enormous disparity, the more you have problems in every social indicator, and the more that people suffer, rich and poor, so that people who are...
And that's where the suicide rates get high as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that interesting thing about that is... when I looked at, you know, where suicides are most prevalent in the U.S., I assumed it was going to be the bottom, you know, of the economic ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that at the very bottom, that's the highest number of suicides. But the next highest isn't the next highest up on that poor ladder. It's the very richest neighborhoods in America are the second highest areas of suicide. And I was really interested to read that, you know, a bunch of, again, scientists looked at this. And they were trying to tease out what the problem was, and they found that these were people who were making slightly less than the people around them. And in fact, for every
10%, so it's a comparative thing.
It was a comparative thing, which also stems from that need to belong. When you're in a high pressure area of a lot of income, your need to belong is great. And they figured out for every 10% less you make from your neighbors, your suicide risk goes up 7.5%.
Oh my
so
gosh.
It's this frantic keeping up with the Joneses thing, you know, which is kind of astonishing. But it's all about belonging. And the idea of not belonging and not keeping up is something we can't bear.
Well, I think that's really true, isn't it? I mean, when I think about what you're saying, I'm going, yeah, there is that kind of pressure in the way we assess one another. He's really important because he has a lot of money. He could be the biggest jerk in town, but he's still more important, right?
Well, this is the way we've defined ourselves as important. This is what we've said is important. I think that, you know, this is changing now, thank goodness. But we have defined that for a long time as success. And we've also kind of fostered an every man for himself attitude, particularly in the States. And I want to say right now and just make it really clear that I'm not advocating across-the-board sameness or socialism. And I say that with reasonable authority because I live in the United Kingdom where there have been socialist policies in the past. And I can tell you hand on heart that many of them have really been a problem. They've, you know, caused a lot of problems. However, that's a far cry from saying that a caring and sharing society shouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying before, the bigger the disparity in income, where there's just these big have and have not, you know, divides, you have problems in every area from crime to education to health, and both rich and poor suffer equally. So when you have that kind of disparity, everybody loses. You see it in some place like New Hampshire. New Hampshire doesn't have any of those social, or doesn't have many of those social problems. It fares very well compared to the rest of the states.
Really?
And it's not, yeah, and it's not because, really interesting, it's not because there are government handouts or there, you know, it's socialist practices. Quite the contrary, there's very little government handout. There just isn't massive disparity between people in terms of income. So, you know, certain people make more than others, but it's not so marked that it causes real social problems.
Hmm.
So, you know, we all have this inbuilt fairness button in our brains, something that's basically an it's not fair button that says, you know, we get bothered if we get too much and more than our fair share compared to other people. We have problems with that in our, and they've shown that in studies. And with people who have less, they don't mind if people have more than them. That's never caused revolution in the past. What they mind is when things are manifestly unfair. Mm-hmm. For instance, after the 2008 financial crisis, what got people so angry was that after ordinary taxpayers bailed out the banks, many people were put out of work, and yet the bankers paid themselves in record bonuses the next year.
Yep.
That sort of manifestly unfair situation makes people's blood boil, because that makes us feel like these people are freeloaders. And I think the sense of inherent fairness, of taking our fair share, of waiting our turn, is absolutely hardwired in the human
And Lynn, another part of that is the powerlessness. When it's so radiant, you can see the swindle, and yet we seem powerless to do something about it. I think that really wraps up the unfairness.
Absolutely. It absolutely feels like there's nothing we can do. And one of the reasons I wrote The Bond was to say there is much we can do. We can recover wholeness. We can recover our lives. We can recover our communities, our relationships, our neighborhood, our sense of wholeness, our sense of purpose. And we don't have to wait for the government or the right president to go ahead and do all of this. We can do this ourselves right here and right now.
So how? Let's get to work on that, because it sounds to me like it would be a better form of politics for us to drop in and work on wholeness and sharing. And that would change all the systems. You're not in the systems at all doing that, are you?
No, I mean, you see right now the government is broken because, you know, Democrats and Republicans are making the most fundamental mistake of all. They're still defining themselves according to a very tightly ring-fenced definition. I'm a Republican. I'm a Democrat. Therefore, I'm not working with this Democratic president. I'm not working with those guys across the aisle. And, of course, nothing gets done.
Right.
America stays broken. You know,
and everyone blames Obama, which I think is kind of like throwing him under the wheels of a bus and then saying, too bad he can't run very well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, no one can operate in this situation. But the point is, we don't have to wait for these guys to fix it.
Goody.
You know, we can do this ourselves. And I'll tell you what, you know, and it's, we can start right here, right now. And there are several things that I write about in detail in The Bond. The first comes with something really basic. It's about seeing holistically, because we're so used to seeing for ourselves and seeing piecemeal, seeing individual things, that we can't see this kind of intergalactic bond. And by bond, I mean a connection so profound in every area of our lives, and it's mimicked all through nature, that it's impossible to see where one thing ends and something else begins.
What are some evidences of that? I think you've got a bunch in the book.
Yeah, well, first of all, subatomically, you know, scientists have always been looking for the thing. You know, they like to take apart the universe like a vast radio and examine its individual parts and say, I can understand the whole by looking at the parts. And when they do that, they keep looking in, you know, at smaller and smaller pieces, subatomic particles. And it's like opening a whole bunch of Russian dolls. There's always another little one inside. And what they find when they get way down there to that most fundamental level of being is nothing. They find nothing. They find a little bit of vibrating air. Hmm. And from there, they recognize that what's happening there in subatomic particles is that they're not particles at all in the sense of a, you know, something solid and separate. They're just a bit of vibrating energy that passes energy back and forth to other packets of energy. And what goes on there is not a bunch of individual things as billiard balls, which is the way they're depicted, but a trade, a relationship. and that that's the only reality there is this relationship. And that, you know, really gets mimicked throughout nature, our bodies. You know, we think of our bodies as being so totally separate, with separate thoughts, with separate actions, with separate biology. And yet, what we're now finding in biology is that our genetic code, which we think is the final blueprint and the individual blueprint, is actually only a set of keys on a piano. And they get played or not, depending on environmental factors. You know, what kind of food we eat, what kind of food our parents ate, what kind of water we take, the relationships we have, the sum total of how we live our lives, that influences whether or not those keys get pushed, those genes get turned on or not. And so, in a sense, we get built from the outside in.
So we don't have to follow the genetic predispositions then?
Oh, no. They're only potentials, you know, as Bruce Lipton always says. That's only a potential. That's not defined in stone. It's the way we live our lives. It's like, you know, it's like the Japanese. It's like many cultures that have a high genetic propensity to, say, depression, and don't get depression because they have such close-knit communities. Those close-knit communities override the genetic tendency to depression. That happens all the way through. Our thoughts, you know, we always think of our thoughts as being so individual, so wholly ours. But we now know that when we see other people doing things having certain emotions, the very same neurons in our brains fire as if we were doing the actions or having the emotions ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so what we're understanding is that the thought patterns we have are a complicated mix of what we see out there, outside and inside. And once again, it's kind of a merging of the environment with us. So
it's not imitation. It's not imitation. It's empathy, right?
It's empathy, and it's also merging, you know, because when you think about it, you know, well, what comes from me and what comes from you? So you start looking at all of this, and you start recognizing that that we are all a complicated mix of outside and inside. And, you know, it gets more and more difficult to say, this alone is me. And, you know, finally we understand that, you know, we always think I'm the captain of my soul. You know, I'm the master of my destiny. And yet we find more and more evidence showing that planetary activity, particularly solar activity, affects us profoundly and biologically.
Yeah, that section of the book is fascinating. I have to reread it. My brow got wrinkled trying to follow that.
Well, there are basically two ideas there. One is that, and this isn't just woo-woo stuff. This is not astrology. We're talking about chrono-astrobiology, as they call it. And there's a lot of work around the world on this, particularly at the University of Minnesota. What they've discovered is that the sun has enormous effects on the two major engines of the body, the heart and the brain. But it also has effects on human motivation. They've looked at things like Jehovah Witnesses, and when they solicit for new recruits for their church, and they found that that motivation goes up and down completely in sync with the sun and solar activity. And so does the stock market. Stock market activity, which of course is human activity, you know, we get confident and so we buy, we get less confident so we sell, and that also rises and falls completely according to solar activity, according to some studies. So that puts pay to the idea that we are completely individual and separate. You know, you put all this stuff together and you realize that you are very much part of an intergalactic bond. And to try to understand yourself, you have to understand yourself in holism.
So the collective
in relation to everything else.
So the collective is important as well. So it's like a pulsing sea of effects, is it?
Yeah. And so you have to understand yourself and also behave not in isolation. And, you know, we find this also in our social behavior, that we're constantly needing to share, care, and be fair. Needing to. Nature has designed this, us to surrender always to holism. You know, we need to do things for other people. We need to give. You know, there are hard wirings in the brain that when we see somebody suffering, fire as though, and it's the same areas of the brain that fire that do when we have, you know, when something happens to our own children. So we've been wired to care. We've been wired to share, as I mentioned. We're also very aware of other people. I mean, we are constantly mimicking other people's emotions. We find it contagious. Mm-hmm. Even our networks of friends, our behavior becomes contagious. If you are happy, you're more likely to have happy friends and have increasingly happy friends. And the reason is not that you're self-selective and you just choose people who are more like you, but that you you have a natural spread of happiness, that happiness spreads to your friends, to your friends' friends, to your friends' friends' friends. And the same thing with things like loneliness. They found lonely people are more likely to have lonely friends because they spread loneliness. Hmm. People who are smokers or who quit smoking are more likely to have smoker friends or smoker friends who quit.
So it's not just a magnetism to people that are like you then?
No, it's not just self-selection. It's your influence on other people.
We create our neighborhood.
We create our neighborhood of likeness because people are so influenced by other people. Huh. You know, if obesity, you're more likely to affect other people and increase people's levels of obesity because not because, you know, you choose fat friends, but because it becomes a new norm for them. They get imbued with that, and they're more likely to be accepting of overweight. So it's all about spreading things.
Well, so where's our individuality? Where is our, like, who am I? How do we start with that in terms of understanding? 'Cause
Well, who you are is a very interesting part of a whole. And I think that's how we have to look at ourselves, you know, because that gives you room for a certain amount of unique expression. But the problem we have is we've taken things too far. We have unique expression, but we feel that that's the only thing that matters. And that we have to put ourself and I and my desires and my needs as paramount. Huh. And as soon as we do that, we start fraying our society at the edges. Huh. I mean, we can see this now in what's happened to relationships. You know, our divorce statistics certainly testify to this, that we put ourselves central in any drama rather than the relationship is central. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, as soon as you do that, you start crumbling that really essential connection.
So what if you get ostracized by, what, family or neighborhood or whatever?
That is probably one of the worst things people can bear. I mean, many societies, like the Amish, reserve shunning, and so did native cultures. They reserve shunning and ostracizing for as the absolute worst punishment because they knew, you know, sometimes it was a matter of life or death. People would kill themselves over that.
Mm-hmm.
So that sense of belonging is so important that, you know, it's as I said before, it's why people kill themselves. They don't fit in, and fitting in is the one thing they absolutely need. So it's not about never having any individual expression, and I'm certainly not advocating communism. But what I'm advocating is understanding and acceptance that we're part of this whole, and that it's not about me, it's about us. And once you start doing that and putting the relationship first, then you can, for instance, accept and be tolerant of difference. It's okay if somebody's different from you, mm-hmm. because you're respecting something deeper, that connection, the space between you.
Hmm. Do you think we can move into that as a culture? I mean, this is America. I'm sorry, but I'm from Canada originally.
Right.
I'm not sure what your research shows, but I think it's a little different there.
I think it's very different there, too. I think it's different. America was founded on a real pioneer and frontier mentality, mm-hmm. of individuals' right to happiness.
Right.
That, again, was a story. But also, we were, you know, it's e pluribus unum, out of many, one. You know, we forgot that one now. We've forgotten that.
Right.
We're so busy pushing individualism in America, we've forgotten what the Founding Fathers said. They very much stressed the idea of collective happiness, too, and the collective and the union itself. And in our history, the great presidents, President Lincoln, valued the union so much, believed that it would be tragic for the union to have been dissolved, because he understood that we were the United States of America. And mm-hmm. we've forgotten that. And everybody's, it's so basic, it's so inherent in our country, you know, our unified vision of this new place. And now we're deteriorating into a squabble between the pieces, mm-hmm. you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, as though the bigger picture is never important.
And it's not really ideology.
No common ground.
And it's not really ideology anymore. It's some sort of marketed thingamabob.
Yeah, it's not about a difference in the ideology. And I want to talk about difference in ideology, because it's very possible for people to have different point of views and get along.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful story I recount in my book that concerns pro-life and pro-choice advocates. Some of the heads of that those areas in Boston and Cambridge, there were some shootings in a Planned Parenthood some years back.
Mm-hmm.
And so the heads of both camps decided they have to come together. They have to begin talking. So they began meeting in secret and having dialogues about what they believed and just sharing with the other side. Now, one changed their point of view, but they just learned to share without emotion.
Hmm.
And they learned to stop their inflammatory name-calling and just talk about why they believed what they believed. So as time wore on, they began watching each other's backs. And the pro-life folks would let the pro-choice people know if they heard that there were any dangers to places like Planned Parenthood, and vice versa. If there was going to be any inflammatory stuff toward them and payback, they let the pro-choice people, let the pro-life people know.
Yeah.
And at the end of a few years, they called a press conference, and they got to the reporters, and they started telling what they'd been doing. And so the reporters said to them, okay, so who won? And they turned to them and said, well, no one won. We both became much more entrenched in our positions and more convinced that we believed in what we believed. And so they said, so it was a failure then. And the both sides said, oh, no, it wasn't a failure. We go out together. We watch each other's children. We party together now. We love each other.
Oh, my gosh.
And so the point was, they still maintained those different points of view, but they were able to come together. They were able to find common ground. They were able to start working together. They started working for things like working to help prevent teen pregnancies, working to help smooth adoption processes for people who did not want to seek abortion. They found common ground without giving up their beliefs. And that's exactly what could happen in our country today if we valued the whole, if we valued the bond beyond valuing what I am right, which is the way we look at things now. We have to feel that we personally are right above all costs. And that's our undoing at the moment.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I do think it's rising in people to have more community consciousness. You know what I mean? Is like we start waking up to these things. So
yeah.
What you're calling the bond, which I absolutely love, I think is rising in more people. And
yes.
I also like when you wrote about the Holocaust survivors and the SS kids.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that? Because that's
sure.
pretty touching.
Well, this was a real wonderful example of how forgiveness really works. You know, because we're always told, oh, just forgive, like, just let it go.
Yeah, really.
And that's really impossible for most of us. So there's a few people, including my dear friend James O'Dea, who used to be the head of Amnesty International in Washington and the head of IONS, and he started working with healing dialogues where they would deliberately put together people who had been really enemies before
mm-hmm.
and let them speak to each other deeply and frankly And so he put together in a group a woman who was the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, and Aunt Mary Rothschild. And she was there, and her partner was Gottfried Lieb, who had been a member of the Hitler Youth Group. And so Lieb was really freaked out about this meeting because he felt, you know, he had really dreaded it. I mean, of all people to meet, you know, his victims, survivors. And so Mary turned to him and said, okay, so did you participate in all of the, you know, brutality to the Jews? And he said, well, you know, when during Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, when they really stormed through and smashed so many Jewish establishments. Mm-hmm. Sorry?
It was Dusseldorf, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And mm-hmm. and he said, well, yeah, I beat up some Jews and I smashed some windows, but, you know, I was only 16. So Mary wasn't satisfied with that one. And she turned to him and she said, and she had been prompted, both of them had been prompted to tell the truth, deep truthfulness, you know, explain exactly how you feel on both sides. And she said, okay, so if you had been 10 years older, would you have sent my relatives to the gas chambers? And he had to look at the floor for a very long time. And he looked up and then said very quietly, you know, I just don't know.
Huh.
And with that, she was just, that ignited something because, you know, they'd got to a whole level, other level of truth at that moment where he was basically admitting to her, you know, I could have been a mass murderer.
Yeah.
And that in some way gave her the release that she needed. There was a great admission of guilt and shame in that. And she went over to him because he was just in despair, and he was the one who was having the difficulty in accepting this and saying, you know, I'm in the dungeon of history forever. You know, I was young, I was impressionable, but I will always be a Nazi. My children will be Nazis. My grandchildren will be Nazis. I'm in the abyss. And she said, walks to him, and she grabs his hand, and she says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. And what she was basically saying is, you know, it's over. It's not you and us and them anymore. You are thou. You are with me. We are here together. And he was just marveling, and there was kind of this divine presence there with the two of them, says Odie to me. And he said that, you know, Gottfried Lieb turns to her and says, you know, this woman has just thrown a bridge across the abyss and invited me to meet her on it. And he was just incredible. And what happened there, and I think this is a kind of little example everyone can use, is that, you know, when there's a wrongdoing, it's like a knot. You know, the perpetrator feels shame and guilt in most cases, and denial. And the victim, even if there is justice, you know, even if the perpetrator goes to jail, for instance, that doesn't untie the knot. The victim still feels like he's been victimized and something has been taken away from him, you know, his personhood. And so when there's this kind of deep dialogue where you tell the truth and you talk to the other person about how you really felt in the situation, that knot gets untied. And it's a way forward. And suddenly you see that even in this extreme situation with you and the other, the very archetype of the other, a connection is always there, always underlying any relationship, even the worst.
Huh. I think that's so wonderful. Is there a lot of this healing dialogue stuff going on around the world?
Well, yeah, it's really in areas of real conflict. I mean, but people like Don Beck and James O'Dea are doing a lot, and a number of others, where they are getting, you know, genocide victims or whatever to speak to the perpetrators. And, you know, from there becomes justice and also forgiveness. But
what about Israeli and Palestinian? Are they using that kind of thing? I mean, there's a lot
definitely.
And the Irish and the, yeah, it's pretty important.
Absolutely. And the Palestinians and I know from Don Beck, I mean, there's another area that's really important in trying to connect together, which is what we were nibbling around the edges of it, which is the idea of creating the bigger goal. Don Beck, who does a lot of work with areas of conflict, he is the fellow who's the author of Spiral Dynamics. He's been working with Palestinians and Israelis and basically says to them, forget what happened in the past. Let's now look at how we can find common ground. And so he's been trying to persuade them that they should work together to create the Hong Kong of the Middle East.
Oh, great.
So what he's really saying, which I think is brilliant, is keep your eye on the big picture. We can all learn to forgive and come together if we have a bigger goal that can only be achieved by the collective efforts of all parties involved. That's called a superordinate goal.
Wow. Yeah, you have a story in there about, I can't remember what the story is, about people who were warring and then got together because they had a crisis of supply or something, a crisis of water.
Oh, well, this was actually a psychological study back in the days before informed consent. There's a bunch of psychologists who sent, they gathered together a group of 12-year-old boys, and they sent them to what they thought was summer camp. And they had sent them in different buses. They weren't allowed to meet, the two groups. They allowed them to come up with their own names, Rattlers and Eagles, they came up with. They had them create their own flags and identity, and they convinced them that there were going to be some very tough challenges and competitions against, and there were going to be very coveted prizes. So all of the camp counselors were psychologists in disguise, and they engineered it so whatever competitions they had were neck and neck all the time, so to really maximize the competition. So they didn't have to engineer anything after a while. The two groups were really at each other's throats. They were starting to kill each other.
Wow.
And, you know, they were ripping up each other's flags. They were fighting. They were beating each other up. They were raiding their living quarters.
It's like Lord of the Flies, eh?
Yeah, it was total Lord of the Flies. And then the psychologists turned it around. They then created a series of crises that could only be solved by the collective efforts of everybody in the camp. So the boys had to work together, and suddenly this animosity began to dissipate. They began to sit together at dinner. They began to play together. They voted on the way home to sit together on the same bus, and one of the heads of one of the groups, who had really hated the other, ended up using all of his pocket money to buy ice creams for the whole gang.
Wow.
And, you know, they became as tight as anything. And that whole idea, it's called a superordinate goal. The idea of working together for a collective effort brings communities together, brings people together. If Congress could only understand this, would bring people, you know, if they could make America their superordinate goal, we wouldn't have the fighting and the stalemate in Congress. We would have actual action. Mm-hmm. But as I say, we can't wait for them to do stuff. We can create these kinds of things in our very neighborhoods. There was a little town called Tailholt, Oklahoma, that was trying and failing to get any kind of federal funding for water. They didn't have barely drinkable water. It was really water that would have failed any kind of, you know, any kind of potable water test. And so finally, they decided to get members of the town together, and they invested in what they call sweat equity. The town's guys said, we'll build the pipeline ourselves. So they got together and they all started digging themselves. They brought their own equipment. The women built, you know, brought lunch for them every day. And they got their pipeline built. They then built a community center themselves, got a tiny bit of funding, did all the stuff themselves, and it brought the whole community together. So it was that another superordinate goal where people were able to solve their problems by getting together and keeping in mind the bigger picture.
Well, is there any kind of research on the fact that when you do something like that, the oneness is maintained over time with any ease? Do you know what I mean? Do people click into that unity?
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you why. There are two things that happen. One is they've had studies of jazz players, and they found when people do stuff together for a common purpose, their brains start resonating in unison.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people who fire together wire together.
Hmm.
And second thing that happens is they saw this with the Oxford rowers over here. There was a study of them showing that when people row together, they have one level of pain threshold. When they row together, when they row alone, they have one level. When they row in a group with their team, they have a much higher pain threshold. So again, what ends up happening is people rowing together, people doing stuff together, raise their own game. So there's plenty of evidence that this kind of work, people who use a superordinate goal in a company, there's a company over here called John Lewis Partnership where they've made it a partnership so that everybody from the lowest packer to the president of the company gets the same percentage of his bonus. They distribute all the profits to all of the employees. There are no shareholders.
Oh,
and
wow.
So every year, it's an amazing company. It's one of Britain's most successful. It's a giant chain.
Huh.
And what happens is, you know, if they make 15% profits, then that 15% profits will be all distributed so everybody gets the same percentage. Let's say it's, you know, 10% of your income or something like that. Everybody will get 10% of their annual income in a bonus. So
how's the mood and morale? Because remember we talked earlier about how people are more prone to suicide when there's disparate incomes and so on. Is it a much more harmonious group? Are they healthier? You know what I mean? Is it?
Oh, it's an amazing group. I mean, even during the recession when other companies were making no money, John Lewis made more money because everybody said, well, it was really tough, but we pulled together. And that's the whole point. They saw it as pulling together. It's part of me. What I do matters, and I'm valued for this as one part of a whole. So that kind of model you can take into almost any area of your life.
Hmm.
Whether it is, you know, whether it is banding together in your neighborhood just to eliminate crime or to fight against cell phone towers, as we did in my town, we were supposed to have cell phone towers. That a big British company threatened to put them all over our neighborhood and our town, and we all got together with a housewife's brigade and we fought it successfully. But what also happened is our community got much closer as a result. We were all working together for a common goal.
Wow. Well, what about over here in America? Are there any companies doing what is it John Lewis Partnership is doing?
Yeah. Dave Barnum is a great success story. He created Hot Dog on a Stick. Hot Dog on a Stick is one of the most successful hot dog franchises. And he decided that he would make it fun. So all the employees get really fun costumes, and they've got white, you know, these white stands, and they were going to use good ingredients. But before he died, Dave did something else. He handed over the company to all of his employees. So they have it just like John Lewis's. It's owned by the employees. And once again, you get this incredible loyalty, this incredible involvement, because people are working together for a common goal.
Hmm.
There are even electricity companies owned as partnerships in America.
Really?
You know, there are enormous companies. And also, if you look at Portland, Portland's a great example of it, too, because Portland had, people for Portland Riverwalk, I think it was called, they wanted to stop when there was a big movement to put a more highway in the riverfront. They said, no, we don't want more highway. We want more park. And so they banded together. They successfully pushed that through. But they also got a taste for being very active civically. And so Portland is one of the most active civic areas in America. We're also a tight-knit group for, you know, particularly for a city. So there are many examples of that all around America as well. It's not just over here, where people have banded together for a superordinate goal, and they find that that is a way to revitalize their neighborhood in any regard.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, there's something, this is kind of a stretch, but you've mentioned Galactic a number of times. When you're talking about the bonding, which I keep reiterating, to me means the oneness of all of us at some level, or our ability to intend en masse and share at a much higher level. Is that right? Would you say that's right?
Yeah.
And you feel, are you implying that we have that ability out in the universe, out in the universes?
Well, I'm still testing that. I mean, I still run the intention experiment. I've run 22 experiments now. We've tested the ability to make plants grow faster successfully. We've changed qualities of water. We had a very provocative study seeming to show that we were lowering violence in a war-torn area.
Ooh.
And I keep pushing the boat out. Whether or not we can change the planets or change things out there in the universe, that remains to be seen. I think it's probably important to have a certain amount of humility here, because we understand that, you know, we are, you know, we're just a little part of a bigger whole. And, you know, man, we always think that we're the dominant species on Earth, mm-hmm. And that we're the dominant species in the world because we have a big neocortex. But, you know, as I say, we're just a little gnat in this whole giant thing. And an important part of the whole, as everything is, you know, an essential part of the whole, but we're just one part of the whole. So the idea that we can dominate everything, I think, is not really part of that.
Well, I heard something that this is not within your the things I've read from you, which I think are wonderful, but I heard that when we did some nuclear testing and we're just doing that kind of thing much more flagrantly than we blew up planets that were way out there in a different galaxy. I have no idea if that's true, and we can't really do scientific experiments on that to see if it's true.
No,
but
I mean, it wouldn't be surprising. You know, we've done a lot of things that, you know, we've been messing around with nature for a very long time and not really knowing the full extent of what we're doing.
But thinking about intention, thinking about intentioning, and thinking about our common, the oneness, I go, I guess whatever we do resonates throughout the galaxies. That's my innocent approach.
Yeah, no, I think that that's true. I think that's true. I think that, you know, what we are just learning the limits of what happens with, you know, the butterfly effect in terms of intention. You know, we don't know. We're finding more and more evidence that little initial conditions have huge ultimate effects. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Huh. This is very, very exciting work that you're doing. What's next, Lynn? And I also know you're coming through the Pacific Northwest, so I intend to get to Mount Vernon and see you next week.
Well, wonderful. Yeah. I'd really love for you to come, and please let us know and be our guest.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, I suppose what's next for me is taking the bond on the road. I'm going on April 22nd. I'll be coming to Pennsylvania, and then over to the Pacific Northwest and up to Vancouver and Boise, Idaho, and then I'm back in another month's time to the whole East Coast, and I'm in the Southwest in the summer, and I'm in California and Toronto and Virginia in October. So I really want to take this whole, all of these ideas on the road, and really, I hope, inspire people to understand that, you know, it's not the end, it's just the beginning, and that we have more, far more power than we realize. And so I think I want my message to be really a message of hope.
Oh, I'm very excited about it. And you're not doing workshops, you're just igniting people through talk and books and so on right now, eh?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I'll be talking about this for a while. And, you know, I think probably taking a little bit of a breather since this book was a very hard book to write.
But, was it?
Yeah, this was the hardest of the three because it was not just the physics and some of the, you know, psi research, as they call it, but it was looking at a lot of frontier areas in so many of the sciences and trying to pull it all together. So it was the biggest sweep I had to do. So
has it impacted your life as well, Lynn?
In what sense? I mean,
well, you've already been involved in community projects. I just wondered if it shifted you in terms of what you're going to do and how to hang out with more people or something.
Oh, yeah, I think it did. Well, I was already starting to feel that community is really important, and as I say, our little efforts in our neighborhood helped. But it's really affected me in a lot of ways. First of all, my daughter, my youngest daughter, goes to a new school, and it's the first time they've had girls in the school, in the lower areas. She's 14. And so the school is really keen to get this right. And I was talking to them the other day about superordinate goals in order to bring people together. And our community with the school is very tight, the parent community. And I've noticed it has a lot to do with the fact that we're all working for a superordinate goal to get the school really up and running. So I've watched it and watched it work really well in areas of my life. And also, it's shifted some of my thoughts about relationships a lot.
Ah,
so you always put the relationship first.
Always put the relationship first. That's good information. I have one more thing I wanted to mention. This is from, I believe, the intention experiment or the last time you and I talked, which was a few years ago. I think I remember that you said that in terms of intention and health and so on, it's easiest to turn bacterial and viral things around with our intentions. Is that right? This is a big jump. This is into your older subject.
Okay. Well, easier than what do you mean?
That it's not that hard to turn it around with consciousness.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's been decent evidence on that that I've relayed in the intention experiment where they've done a number of studies showing that you can retard or encourage bacteria according to whether you send positive or negative intentions. There was a very good study with E. coli bacteria, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember that, but I just wanted to tack it on at the end because people are so worried about a lot of that kind of thing these days, bacteria, viruses, and so on. And I keep saying, Lynn McTaggart says in her research, well, I think it's important. People want to feel empowered. We don't want to feel afraid of each other for we might catch
yes.
each other's hoo-ha or whatever, you know. It's a pretty
yes.
small planet right now, isn't it?
Well, I think that whole idea of being so frightened of bacteria, things like that, there's certain things to be frightened of, but I think, you know, you can get to be too clean and then you have more problems when you are confronted with bacteria. You know, your body needs a chance to understand how to combat it. But yeah, there is some really good evidence about sending intention to bacteria, et cetera.
And I That's love important. That. This has been so wonderful. Give everybody your website and the name of the newsletter you're involved in, and we'll have to say goodbye and see you in the Northwest.
Wonderful. Well, my latest website, which is just up, is www.thebond.net. And we have a bunch of programs and teleseminars that we'll be running very shortly about, which will help to train people to take Bond into their lives.
Yay!
Yeah, and we'll be talking about that at some of my workshops in the Northwest. I've got a big workshop as well as talks in Seattle, Mount Vernon, Bellingham, Vancouver, and I have a workshop on the Saturday in Vancouver. All of those details about my upcoming appearances are also on thebond.net, and I'm looking forward to seeing everybody who's out there in the Northwest. Looking forward to seeing people in Bellingham and also communicating with people joining our community, thebond.net, where they can join with others who are trying to take this into their lives too.
Wonderful. Lynn McTaggart, it's been a very delightful hour. Thank you so much, and thanks for your work.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Take care. Bye.